Does Bill know to come to Skype?
I would assume so, but I didn't explicitly tell him. Let me do this.
I just sent him an email.
It's Robin Tunney's birthday today.
What, Doug?
Hit Robin Tunney's birthday.
Oh, is it? Whoop-de-fucking-do.
Okay, so here's something that speaks volumes about our age that we were talking about. Let me find Bill.
That's it right there, right? So like, this is, we've shown that the stars below resonate the stars above, right? Okay, so we could say this is like this. The question I think ultimately that we're trying to discuss here is like, is there more authenticity to the above, or is it literally as above, so below? Should the celebrities become our new stars? Is it a thing of, well, they already are, you know, there's no arguing it. They are, so just accept that. But do they deserve the same reverence? Are they as beautiful? Are they, you know, do they have that? I mean, I think ultimately what we're getting at here is like, yes, they resonate the same, but is there that sort of beauty, that majesty there? And I don't see, when I look at this night sky, I get a feeling that I don't get from, you know, looking at Robin Tunney.
Okay, well, so I'm actually in the middle of kind of an existential crisis for Book of Stars.
Okay.
Because, so I know what I'm going to write, but then at the same time, are we writing a book for like 8 people? Everyone else is in the flow. They're perfectly happy. They don't need a mythological structure because they're in the mythological structure. They don't need to understand the mythological structure because they get it. They know. You know, even though it's not explicitly stated, they don't need to articulate. You know, like if you were to ask, this keeps coming up. An anthropologist looks at a tribe's mythological structure or whatever. They can't explain it to you because they are in the thing, but it makes perfect sense to them. So I'm watching the Rihanna video and I'm trying to understand it. I'm trying to understand our moment and our age and like our flavor and our aesthetic. And that's why I want to do Book of Stars, because it's like, look, we have a mythological structure. It's just, and we have meaning. And, you know, I want to try and satisfy Joseph Campbell's 4 functions, you know, for a complete mythology, to see if we can put the stars in a book and unite heaven and earth. You know, this is a goal of mine, but at the same time, it's like, who is this for?
Oh, you
just,
yeah,
just me. Is it just for me? Is this what I need? And then I'm going to try and include everyone in on the one thing. You know, am I the only one with any interest in this?
The answer to that is no. I mean, is a yes and no. I mean, I kind of made myself crazy with that same thought with the book I'm writing, Suicide Kings. It's like,
But you're at least examining.
Well,
this,
I don't know if it's
this thing you see, whereas I'm have the audacity to say, you know, I'm telling people that we're lacking something, and this book is going to satisfy this need. Like, we're going to put it all together in this book.
Oh, well, then you're setting yourself up to go crazy. I mean, either way, like, so just to say, is like, I at some point thought to myself, who am I writing this for? Who needs this? You know, like, when I did Happy Creatures, I had a sense of mission, a sense of, like, you know, okay, I need to write this book. This is my attempt at, you know, saving the world. Just like you were when you were writing Winter's Labyrinth. It was like, here's what I just feel the need to express this, you know, struggle, whether that, you know, whether it be a personal, ecological, all the concerns you had, and just sort of like, you had a sense of mission. With these other things, it's like, I think there's a temptation to try and write as if you can tell somebody. And what I realized, I struggled with it for a while, and when I very quickly realized was, no, just be honest, is, hey, I'm trying to figure this fucking thing out. This is what I've come up with. This is some crazy shit that I've noticed. Are you interested in help, like, looking at this crazy shit with me? If so, great. But if I were to try and write a book as some sort of authority of, like, let me show you this and tell you what it means, you know, I have my ideas, but so does everyone else. So why, you know, and then I was trying to be all-inclusive. So then I should include this guy's idea and this guy's idea and this guy's idea and just present a really nice cross-section of, you know, thoughts on what this all could mean. And then it's just like, let me just show you this crazy shit. Isn't this fun? You know, that's what interests me. Honestly, that's my passion, is, you know, that same sense of purpose. My sense of purpose has been, wow, look at this. This is amazing. This is the puzzle. This is my Rubik's Cube. You know, I enjoy it. And based on the blogs and everything, I get a feeling that other people like it too. They, you know, they enjoy the game, if nothing else. I don't want to have a game just for game's sake, but I don't know. It's, you know, it's this idea that I'm enjoying playing. Maybe other people want to play too. Sorry, I just got a text from Bill Klaus saying he's going to come on in a moment.
Okay, so the way my mind works is, I've been told that, okay, so the universe is a puzzle, right?
And possibly Pandora's box. I mean, you know.
Okay, so, but elements are not functioning. So, okay, it's, humans have created an imbalance with nature that is going to harm us, or is harming us, and that if this is a puzzle, that there can be a solution. Now, the contemporary way of dealing with the problems that the past have created is oftentimes more of the same. So with enough advancement, somehow we'll solve the problems of the past. You know, it's always technology that's going to save us. But so the way, you know, I've latched onto this, this is so, it's such a big conversation, but, you know, I've looked at a number of different paths into this thing to say, okay, so we can't create a utopia, but if we were going to be in balance, how would we live? So basically that's my question. How should one live? And that's always been the thing that I've operated from. Okay, so if things are bad, or not bad, but things are malfunctioning or things are out of balance here, how should one live in response to that? You know, and so you have the world functioning as this macrocosm, and there's an age and an aesthetic and attitudes and things. And so if your goal is to wake up that macrocosm, to to their unconsciousness, you know, so you Hello. Have to... Hey.
Hey. Yo, yo.
Go ahead.
So what I was saying is, if with that kernel, idea, you know, how should one live?
How should one live?
How should one live?
Wow, that's a big one.
Yes. And so I've explored a number of different facets within that, right? And one of the main facets is mythology. And so Joseph Campbell thought that what was lacking in modernity was a complete mythological structure.
I like that.
But in my own research, I think I've almost found that it's that we have a mythology. It's almost like our structures are out of balance because the farther we become removed from like these authentic networks, the more difficult. Well, see, our Western ideas of property
Am I wrong that you're struggling with that same question? Basically, I was raising, you're saying like when it's in, is it inauthentic or not? You know, it's like,
well, for who? That's the question. So this who's lacking a complete mythological structure? Is it the world or is it me?
Right.
And
well,
maybe you're
in exile right now. You know, maybe you do have that mythological structure. You're a jigsaw piece without a jigsaw puzzle, you know?
I watched the Twin Peaks, the full, you know, two seasons recently, and I just finished watching them last week. I think it's in the last episode, you know, there's building this idea that this one guy dies and he leaves, you know, this puzzle box to his nemesis, and they're trying to figure out how to open the puzzle box, and then you have to slide it a certain way, and then finally they open the first layer, and then there's another box, then there's like a code you have to enter, and then they enter the code, and then there's another box and they can't open it. Finally they take a gun and they just shoot it, and then okay, there's a key inside, and then they find out where the key belongs, and it belongs to a safe deposit box, and they go to the safe deposit box and they put the key in and they open it. And there's a bomb, and it says, like, ha-ha, got you, and then they blow up. You know, it was like, it's basically Pandora's box. It's like, yeah, you got it open, you know, now great for you. you know, now you get the big bang, and now you get to start all over again. You know, it's the end of the series and the beginning of a new possibility, I suppose. It's what I thought was on a whole other level was, an amazing sync. In our last Always Record, we mentioned this Twilight Zone episode where the guy flips the coin and the coin lands on its edge. Well, I found the episode. What's amazing to me is not only is the main character's name Hector Poole, resonating with the Deadpool that we've been all hitting with, but he works for a bank. And one of the major plot points in the episode is that this, you know, this man is going to rob the bank. He gets this psychic impression that someone's going to go into the bank vault and steal everything. And in the Twin Peaks episode, there's this focus on the bank vault, which is actually where they end up. The safe deposit box is inside the bank vault. So I just thought it was hilarious that I sort of watched these two things back to back. You know, so there's definitely something in there, but it's not perhaps not what we think it is. It's, and maybe we can just bring that back to Doug's idea of, you know, the idea of ownership. It's like we're trying to lock something up. We're trying to think we have some sort of wealth, but perhaps the wealth that we think we have, and whether we take this from a very rational, like, paper money is worthless or the economy sucks from a very, like, 3D rational perspective, or from a more metaphysical perspective of what we think is our wealth, what we think we own actually owns us and is ultimately plastic shit.
For sure. I think that the symmetry of the Twilight Zone with the Twin Peaks is perfect, because I think that, you know, the whole mystery box in Twin Peaks and how they're trying to get it open, and ultimately it leads them to a bank where there's an explosion and they die, is a perfect, you know, metaphor for our hunt for the secrets of matter, right? Like, we approached the mystery of splitting the atom. Did we approach it out of pure scientific inquiry, or was it out of a lust of wealth and a lust for power? Because I think when you approach something that cosmic, the way in which you approach it isn't the way in which it approaches you, right? You stare into the abyss and the abyss stares back at you. So if we approached the splitting of the atom in the way we did, we have the atomic bomb. If we had approached it from a more scientific and more mythological way, then we have cold fusion. Then we have free energy. Then we have this great gift. Much like in the way we approached electricity. If we approach it out of the way of wealth, then you have Edison and you have AT&T and you have, you know, ComEd and you have all these companies. But if you approached it with Tesla, then you have wireless energy, you have improvement, you have great gain, which is really just astonishing how simple it really seems to be. And just how we, like you said, Alan, we project our own will into this thing. We create as we perceive. You know, it's a two-way street. There's, once you get your hands on it, you're affecting it completely. And do we cancel out that other road due to how we've approached these things? Was our one chance, like when we got electricity, did we lose our chance right there? Did we get another chance with atomic energy? Did we lose our chance when we got fire? You know, the whole thing about Fire Walk With Me with Lynch, you know, that is the moment where man, you know, took a leap forward. And I bet you that fire was discovered with the most pure of intentions. And it carried us into this drama. But maybe the story ended with, you know, those events in Japan. Maybe it's all true. You know, maybe this is just the decline. I don't know. It's troubling, but fantastic at the same time, because, you know, it's surreal, our powers. It's surreal how much we are capable of and how much we're not doing. You know, I had written when Doug was talking just a few minutes earlier that we're not deluded, we're just diluted, you know, that we don't have it all wrong. We've just watered the thing down. We're the power of human ability. Every child should grasp all this. Every child should be born with a complex mythology, not with a trinity. You know what I mean? To boil down all of life into a trinity is something that a very, very wise person should be able to do by when they're 70. You know, to fold it all into a very simple thing. But to start someone off with a trinity just seems like a very, very disturbing shortcut. It's a delusion, not a delusion. And I think that's exactly what we're dealing with here.
That's interesting, because I hate to take it back to this. It's just, this is where my head is at. So I'm sorry, this is my context. But one of the things I've been struggling with writing this book is that the idea of how much do people, how much do I assume people are already familiar with? You know, so is it the, am I trying to, you know, show somebody something, and can I just, like, you know, there's the distinction between Mask of God. The way we write a Mask of God, it's sort of like, you know, throwing it out there. We're sort of talking amongst people who already know what we're talking about. When we're doing Always Record, we're sort of going from this idea of like, hey, let's just talk. And it's like, we're not explaining unless someone stops and says, wait, I didn't get that. What do you mean by that? But for the audience, they have no way of doing that. So it's this idea of like, do we jump to the advanced material and do we assume that people are already on the same page? Or do we sort of like walk someone through the process? And that was just something that I kind of struggled with. And I think your idea of, you know, it's this idea to give someone a trinity and say that that's so simplified, you know, are we, if we think of it as like almost like minimalist art, right? You know, that the Holy Trinity is like minimalist religion. Like, okay, we're going to like boil this down and just show you the basic components here of how this works. And honestly, I think from a minimalist standpoint, I think the Trinity is a really awesome distillation. But yeah, it can also be oversimplified.
The screw up is that they give you the Trinity, but they tell you that you're not allowed to deconstruct it.
Well, yeah, you know, that's a control system, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that ultimately, even though it's not explicit in, even though those kind of doctrines aren't explicitly religious, I think it's the dominant programming of most people in the Western world. And when people start to deconstruct that and they get into religious areas or mythological areas or areas that have already been dealt with, maybe they think that that's a dead end. You know, maybe they get fascinated by brand new culture and they stop their deconstruction and say, well, if there was any meaning in this backwards path, it's already being given to me in this forward dimension. So they stop their search. And so, you know, the cattle and the sheep are led away from the fields of glory and they're just herded into the slaughterhouse. A little dark for sure. But I mean, I don't know when the last time you spent 15 minutes watching broadcast TV or network TV. I feel like I'm being slaughtered with every second. It's horrifying.
Yeah, I really have a hard. It's like this is why someone, you know, people make fun of me, particularly in the sync community. I have the people I know outside of our internet communities. They all, you know, you meet people. And
are you saying you have friends, Alan?
I actually have very few, but you know, it's the idea that you know, when you talk, I just have a hard time engaging with people because people talk about, oh, did you see the last episode of whatever? And it's like, I don't watch TV. And then I found this awesome internet community, and now I'm trying to keep up with, like, every day Jason Brera watches 3 movies and he's talking about it. And it's like, I don't have the time to watch 3 movies, and I don't actually even want to. Like, I love movies. I love books. I love media. Like, I love the capabilities of it. It's just like, I don't want to be a, you know, consumed by it. I don't want to consume it all the time, and I don't want to be consumed by it. I don't enjoy television, you know. So it's this funny thing of people making references to things that, like, there's a temptation to almost want to know what they're talking about so I can partake in the conversation, but I don't enjoy it. I find watching TV to be so unpleasant. I find it makes me physically ill to watch TV. And I don't mean that as an exaggeration. I'm saying, like,
I agree with you completely. You took the words out of my mouth. I mean, it's a physical reaction. It's that poison again. It's just that poison, and it infects. And at least I've been able to just turn it off, you know, and to not have any hesitation whatsoever about it.
But then I'm having the same thoughts about what we do a little bit. Where an individual wants to relax. So they engage with this fantasy. And what we do is active fantasy, but then it's engrossing and it's fun and it's an amusement and I want to do it more and more, but it almost like, again, I'm creating the two world scenario where there's the world, and you can do the same thing with books or any, whatever amusement you have that tries to, you know, where you let go for the moment. Any game, any construct where you submit your consciousness to that construct's rules, you know, like whether it's chess or the Rubik's Cube, you know, where, and reading is so much so because it requires such a level of concentration that, you know, we developed later. You know, if you look at Marshall McLuhan, you know, normal consciousness is more like the internet where you've got this nonlinear, all kinds of things happening simultaneous, you know? So if you're like a bushman, you're out there and you're trying to pay attention to everything around you, you're not focused on a linear sentence in front of you at the detriment of everything around you. That wouldn't be evolutionarily sane because you've got to be aware of the wolves and the tigers and where the nearest tree is and all this kind of stuff. But you know, what we did with books where we were able to take all our concentration and put it into this one linear structure and then follow the path, follow the labyrinth. It's fascinating to me, but I feel that duality because there's reality and then there's less real versions of the reality. So they, like, it's fascinating to me how every year the sync community becomes more real. Like we're bringing these avatars into reality and interacting with each other more and more authentically, but there's still this split kind of, you know, where it's still happening out there and not because, I mean, that's the strangeness of contemporary life where you can have conversations. Like I had a wonderful conversation with Alex Robinson the other night. She's in New Zealand and it was just one of these spontaneous things where I'm on Skype waiting for my wife to Skype me from Japan. And then I have a conversation with someone in New Zealand. Now she's not part of my life, but she is part of my life. And so how do we balance the people that are physically in my life and the people that are abstractly but physically in my life too?
Excellent question. I mean, I think that's what we're trying to do by sort of bringing this into reality by like, you know, we last summer, a bunch of us got together, Doug, you know you were there. I'm telling Bill. I mean, last summer, right before the Sync book came out, I had the first copy of the proof, and my wife's friend was getting married in Seattle, so we were going to the West Coast for a wedding, and it was just sort of like Michael from Gosporn lives in Seattle, Crystal from Constellation Contemplation lives in Seattle, and Doug and Jason drove up from Idaho. Justin Morgan drove up from, I know they're like somewhere around like San Francisco. And Andras Jones from Olympia. And we just sort of like, you know, which is much closer to Seattle. We all sort of like got together just for a few days. And it was really interesting to get together like in reality, you know? And like there was at one level, there's this total level of comfort of like, hey, I know all you. And then at the same time, there's still that like, well, I don't really know you. Are you possibly like the creepiest asshole in the universe? I don't know. There was a moment I wasn't sure if Doug was gonna kill us all with an axe. He was talking about the Shining and going to room 237, and we get to this cabin in the woods, and he pulls out an axe, and I'm like, "Oh my god, is this guy gonna kill us all?"
This is happening. This is happening.
This is totally happening.
Well, you know,
Alan and I both had weddings the same weekend, and I was a groomsman in my wedding, and we called him the Alchemical Wedding. Because I think they happen on the same day, but I was given a throwing axe for being a groomsman, and it was just too cool that I couldn't bring it to the woods with us, because then, you know, you're in the woods, what do you have to do? Because the activity really doesn't matter. It's the individuals participating in the activity. So the story that animates reality doesn't matter, just so long as everyone agrees on the story. And that's probably why it's a monomyth. So everyone wants a different version of the story, but it ends up being the same story. So just so we can share the experience together. So long as we have an activity, whether it's playing chess or washing dishes or just sitting around a campfire and poking with a stick, you know.
Well, you know,
Crystal's schizophrenic god is the closest thing that I can grab onto to give me comfort as far as why, you know, why? Because the only way to experience everything is to crack up and then to come back together and bring all those unique individual finite little pieces back together to see all the different angles that you couldn't see with an omnipresent point of view.
This idea of the monomyth, I visualize as fabric, right? And if you have certain types of fabric, certain ones have a different feel to it than others. And that's because of thread count, right? And for most people, a more comfortable and a more desirable fabric is one with a higher thread count. So you can say, you know, there's different levels of the monomyth. You can express it with 100 threads, but if the rarer one, the one that was created with more care and with more time, is the one with a higher thread count, with maybe 500 thread count, you know? And then maybe there's a way to go even further. But then at a certain point, it probably ceases to become fabric and it becomes stone, or it becomes something radically different. It changes and it transitions. And I'm thinking that that's essentially what our role is in the middle of all this, is that we are becoming aware of all the different types of threads that this monomyth offers, and we're putting them all together. And by reaching out through the internet, we're learning of different colors and different materials, and slowly but surely, and maybe even beyond our grasp right now, we have started to create this fabric that we will pass down as an example to others. I mean, to me, it's probably my favorite metaphor for the monomyth that I have going right now. And and I think that when you guys all met up in the cabin, even if you hadn't met in person before, even if you had some doubts as to whether or not these people were the creepiest assholes on the planet, I mean, you had enough tactile experience through a computer to know that was the minority outcome of that event. The thread count was already so high that even through a computer screen, you knew that everything was going to be okay.
Absolutely. I mean, it was mostly a joke. I mean, I really have to say how wonderful and natural it was to just, you know, for the most part, it was really just very natural. Like, oh, okay. Oh, there's Doug. Oh, there's Jason.
It's kind of like the Hogwarts experience, where when he gets around people like him, it feels right. It's like, oh, I'm not a freak. Or here are the 8 other freaks in the world. This feels great.
Yeah, I think that is a perfect example of that. And is that whole find the others mantra of Timothy Leary. You know, once you turn on to this stuff, you've just begun. You have to go out and find the others. I mean, and there hasn't been a greater tool ever invented than the internet. I mean, it's designed for exactly that stage of the process. But these constructs that we have in our heads, to go back to Timothy Leary and to go back to what I think is sort of is the central evidence of the whole thing, is to just quickly go back to the Rubik's Cube. Somebody who messes around with it randomly and creates patterns has those sort of routes in their brain. But somebody who knows how to navigate and understands why they're able to navigate the Rubik's Cube, they start to build and engrave within their mind certain creodes of thought or pipelines. And then when you take a psychedelic and the light and the wisdom floods your brain, the brain has somewhere to put that light and to put that wisdom. And when that light hits those engraved pathways that you've put in there through your study of the Rubik's Cube, in that moment, you're better able to bring something back from the experience, right? And if one has within one's head the mechanics and the framework of Finnegan's Wake in one's brain, and then turns on to that light and it floods the system, they're going to be able to bring back, I guess, what it is that we call art to give to someone else, you know? And that is the goal. I mean, Alan, I'm looking forward greatly to your book that's coming out. And I've yet to read your book, Doug, but I definitely have that on my short list of things to read.
So there's the, like, turning it into art, which is a beautiful. I mean, I think Doug and I, it's pretty funny, like, on separate attempts at, you know, working out the Rubik's Cube, we both came to the same answers. Like, we were getting a little frustrated with the world and with, you know, certain elements that we were just, like, you know, keep beating your head against, and the only real answer that made sense was to turn it into artwork. Well, the funny thing here is that while you guys were talking, I was just making a quick little image in Photoshop. And as soon as I sent it to you, so I was working with taking the equalizer of, like, music. We were talking about Rihanna, and the music producer, you know, takes all the elements and remixes them. I was picturing an equalizer as a Rubik's Cube, those same sort of, like, you know, square, colored squares that keep changing. And so I just sort of wanted to play with that. And the minute I sent you this Rubik's Cube image is the exact moment you said, bringing it back to the Rubik's Cube, you know, these amazing synchronicities are the things that really ground me. Like, as much as they could be overwhelming and mysterious at times as to what the larger phenomenon is, I actually find them incredibly grounding, because when I'm sitting there going, I don't know, the world's kind of fucked up and everything's kind of whatever, and then amazing sync happens and you go, no, you know what, universe is pretty damn awesome.
Here's the thought. So last night the kids and I started watching E.T. But the thing that is always so striking when I watch a Spielberg film is that he is definitely a man of his times, and so he tries to, I don't know if it's conscious, but he fills and this is why it's so reassuring to me, he fills the screen with pop, just so much pop culture, you know? So when I watch E.T., I am amazed at how similar the wardrobe that I had and Elliot had are like the same stuff. They're ordering the clothes from the same catalog. You know, I don't know. But then the toys and everything, all the little details are not like, there's no hipsterness to it. It's like fully embracing pop culture. And, you know, the same with Close Encounters. I just get that feeling like this is a moment that captures that moment of time. And so we're coming at reality or like pop culture with kind of a judgment about it, that somehow the pop culture that's celebrated in Steven Spielberg's 70s and 80s is leading to this plastic, like, you know, the kids are drinking Coke and stuff in all the movies. And so there's all these different Reese's Pieces stuff, you know, where this, these delicious treats of the past are going to create an obese and depressed America.
Yeah. I love that you brought up fucking E.T. When Melissa left this morning, I said to her, because I knew we were going to do 42 minutes, I said, can you leave the phone home? And then I started, and because we had been, oh God, it's a stupid thing, but last night I was peeling an avocado. Instead of slicing it open, I was peeling it because I wanted to do something with it. And it looked to me like the movie poster for Alien, you know, where it's like that cracked egg with the green glow inside. So
absolutely,
we got into talking about aliens and whatever. So then I said, oh, can you do me a favor, leave your phone home? And then I was slapping like E.T. phone home. So I love that you just brought that up. I wonder if we haven't kind of made this hipster sort of self-conscious quality about our stuff because, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you didn't psychoanalyze your pop song. It just was what it was. You know, your catalog where you bought your clothes was the catalog where you bought your clothes, and the song on the radio was the song on the radio. I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I assume that that's essentially how it was. And I think we hit this sort of media saturation point where you have so many options that you start to actually, you know, put judgments on things. Instead of having three TV channels, you have 300. So if you're watching this one and I watch this one, it's because I like this better. That means mine is better than yours. We don't all have the same media anymore. And then you start to psychoanalyze your own pop culture, your own choices, your own media choices, and then ultimately, like a human being can become self-conscious of themselves, I think we're a society that's becoming self-conscious with themselves. Doug, can you mute your mic? There's a ton of or not. But I think ultimately we become a society that's become self-conscious with themselves. And
We were talking, like, to connect to the earliest conversation about the idea of solipsism.
Yeah.
And so if we all become our own little media directors, it's difficult to interact with other people because of the 1,000 channels. We don't have the thing in common to discuss.
But my question is, do we need to discuss what was on, like, Oprah Winfrey today? Or can we discuss?
Well, maybe it doesn't matter so long as there is, like, something at the core that we all agree on.
Right.
And that's civilization or culture. And it's just right now. So I've been reading The Great Gatsby, and it's fabulous, but I imagine that, you know, it was a party time. So there was lots of smoking and drinking and loose morals. And so I'm sure that some people in that were really judgmental of these young people and how they were living. But how they were living was a response to how screwed up World War I was. That like everything broke down because nothing, like all the things, the bedrock, the foundation of civilization, the idea that we can just go and murder, just like destroy so horrifically. How do you respond to that? You know, and you have Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald in Paris, you know, partying, nonstop partying.
Sure, you know, fast buggies, fast women.
But, right. And so the gold, you know, the roaring 20s were roaring because it was a response to, and then a response to that is like the fascism, where like you people are out of control. This is not how one should live. And then we end up with World War II. And, you know, it just seems like.
Oh, okay, but can I?
It's easier to look back at something that's happened and feel comfortable with it than being in something and either coming to terms with that something, the zeitgeist, or trying to change. I don't even
that's,
know.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, what are we doing? Look, when I was saying as a culture, we've become self-conscious with ourselves, right? It's like, you know, but we've become like that sort of really disgusting, you know, it's the white man's burden type deal. It's like as Americans, we're like, oh, I think it's terrible that we go and, like, you know, colonize countries and bomb the shit out of a bunch of brown people. And, you know, I think that's terrible. And let's psychoanalyze, you know, and let's talk about what it is that makes us do this. Instead of going, wait a second, let's fucking stop it. Let's actually, you know, put the brakes on this. Instead of, like, talking about it and analyzing it. And, you know, sort of being the armchair, you know, expert or critic or anything. I don't know. I mean, is that, I guess it's that like call to action that can create fascism, even if you think you're well motivated. But I just have a hard time, like, you know, we talk about all these things and we go like, oh, yeah, you know, you see how Western culture is. And it's like, but at the same time, you know, I'm sure many of us are still paying taxes that pay for these bombs, and, you know, we're still, you know, a lot of people are still voting in this system. It's like, I don't mean to take this in a political direction, but it's the idea of when you know, the idea of talking about it, analyzing it, or changing it. And the question is, at what point do we say this is something that perhaps is worth changing?
Well, Alan, okay. Real quick, and don't take offense at this. And what brand of cigarettes do you smoke?
Marlboro Lights.
Okay. And you know that Marlboro Light tobacco is a far cry from natural tobacco,
absolutely,
correct?
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right. So you know the whole rap, that this corporate entity engineered the plant to become more addictive so that it could sell more product. And in the process, it became more carcinogenic. And death and poison.
Absolutely.
Okay. So now in the whole Arms of Cthulhu thing, that the tip of Cthulhu is the tip of your cigarette. And every time you light it, you are engaging the beast that is poison and cancer.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you recognize that. You know that. And you know that just individually – you can shoot an arrow into the chthonic beast by never spending another dollar on that product, correct?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So why is it that you can't just stop?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And, you know, for the short answer is I've been making attempts to, but the full answer is, yeah, it's fucking a lot harder than it is, you know, than we make it out to be by just saying, you know, just fucking change.
So as above, so below. Think of the momentum of all of human history, a history that is an engine of war, slavery, greed, money, power. Well, it's addicting, and it has a force that rages beyond the scope of our physical genesis. You know, it's been going on for so long that to expect, you know, President Obama to just get into a little office and say, stop, stop, this is madness, we must stop. And the world just goes, he's got a fucking point, let's stop. It just doesn't fucking work that
way. Of
course, right?
But your point is incredibly valid, so I don't mean to challenge the point, but just to clarify, is I'm not looking for Obama to get up there and do that. Although I do think he certainly should, as a, you know, just to not be a fucking hypocrite, I certainly think he should say that, even whether or not he can actually be successful at it or not. That certainly seems like the appropriate course of action. But regardless, my thing is not to look for a politician to do it. You know, so it's not a thing of like, oh, Obama's not. Here's the deal. Obama doesn't have to get up there and say, hey, everyone stop, and he doesn't have to stop all of human history with a flip of a switch by himself. But he certainly doesn't have to go and actively invade 8 more countries. So there's the distinction between me sitting here and having the occasional cigarette and me getting, if I right now in the middle of this recording said, hey, everybody, don't forget to smoke Marlboro Lights, you know, like that's the distinction. I'm not promoting or trying to get other people addicted. I know what it did to me, and I try and discourage other people from ever getting addicted. I try and discourage people from starting. That's the one sort of clarifying comment there, is that even if Obama, I don't expect Obama or any politician to turn off human history with the flip of a switch, but you don't have to, you know, go extremely the other way either and say, well, you know, you can't beat them, join them. Let's invade 8 countries, and, you know, you don't have to do that.
You could change the entire scope of human history if every human being went on a strike and they said, we will not turn on a television, we will not light up a cigarette, and we will not eat fast food. If everybody just said for a month, you know, a strike, just like Martin Luther King, you know, just go on strike, we're going to stop, and we will let the system feel the effects of that strike, right? Of that stance, just a stance against crap and poison. You know what I mean? No more crap and poison. Now, the problem is that if everyone did that, within 2 days, some family member is going to say, hey, listen, you know, I work at the McDonald's, and you're not going to McDonald's, and I need this job, because if I don't have this paycheck, yeah, then I can't fucking get my rent. And then all of a sudden, you see just how ingratiated this beast is into all facets of everything we do in the Western world.
That's exactly and, where and the crap it, and poison.
What was that?
We're the crap and the poison. Yeah. How do you completely change? So we're talking about, like, we're outside of the system, like we can see it, and we say, oh, you guys are, you know, how should one live? Not like you guys, not like this. But then when you make a statement like, whatever, you know, you should eat differently, we shouldn't start wars, we should behave this way or this way, you know, we're talking about completely reorganizing society. There's no simple way to do it. You know, so like, we should change the tax code. Well, what about all the people who are employed because of the tax code? What happens to them? So like, all these restructurings are like really painful.
We are the shit. I mean, it's like, no, we're not in the shit. We are the shit. This is one of my favorite songs, Frank Zappa. Called Plastic People, right? Which is basically, you know, talking about how everything's, you know, we're just consuming plastic, and, you know, it's got lines about putting all the toxic gel in your hair and hairspray and toxic cosmetics on your face. And then there's a line, it's like, you know, take the day, walk around, watch the Nazis run your town, then go
Jesus
then go home and check yourselves. You think we're talking about someone else, but you're plastic people.
It's fucking great, man.
Yeah.
No, we're definitely, like, the movie The Graduate captured it. You know, what one word for you? Plastics. You know, that was, and plastic is so magic because it allowed us to do things so cheaply and so effectively that we've never been able to, but so much less authentically too, is what's...
I don't know if they did it in the actual movie, but I remember when, you know, the Kevin Smith movie Dogma with, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon.
Yeah.
I don't know if they actually did it in the movie, but I remember reading the screenplay before they actually released the movie, and it was when what's-her-name comes out as God at the end, the musician, God.
Morissette.
Yes, thank you, Alanis Morissette. When Alanis Morissette comes out, she doesn't say anything, and then there's a line where he says, like, hey, can you tell me the meaning of life? And she whispers in his ear, plastic.
Really?
Yeah. That was. I don't know if they actually did it in the movie, but that was the... I haven't seen the movies in years, but I remember I had a friend that was like so into Kevin Smith, and so he got a copy of the screenplay before the movie even came out. And I remember that sort of has always kind of lingered with me, the idea that, like, why did someone choose that word as, like, I'm going to have God say what the meaning of life is right now, and I'm going to say plastic. And it's always sort of lingered in my mind.
Well, it's that whole... that Philip K. Dick thing with the hologrammatic Torah, where you take the Torah and you expand it into a three-dimensional hologram, and then you take one word and you view the entire structure through that one word, and you see how all of reality looks through that perspective, right? So when, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 42, well, maybe he knew and maybe he didn't, but if you look through the answer to the universe through the lens of 42, all of a sudden you get this interest in Stanley Kubrick, in astrology. You start to search out all these different areas where 42 pops up. So if you put plastics instead of 42 and you look through the entire structure through plastics, well, then maybe you find that Frank Zappa song and you start thinking about reality through the focus of plastics, you know, Choose your word wisely. And when you have that moment, grab the people's attention and give them an angle to look through it. You know, Crowley had his word. Sigmund Freud had his word. Jung had his word. And they present just a lens for you to consider the whole thing, because they know you can't consider everything. But if you look through their lens, you'll start to get at least a better understanding than you did before. That's at least my working model on the whole thing. I mean, what the Beatles was love, right? That's what they were selling. That's why they're in the hearts of so many millions, and they'll be around probably forever, is because essentially that's the word that they resurrected after a couple of world wars. They sold an idea and a word that transcended all boundaries and all lines.
Right. Now we're at a point, because of the sort of hipster snark, we're at a point that if you did make the movie Dogma now and you said, what's the meaning of life? And if Alanis Morissette leaned over and said, love, everyone would be like, oh, that's some corny ass shit. Right.
Yeah.
That's the age of, like, cynic snark that we're at, instead of going like, well, that would be a much better fucking answer than plastic. But of course, maybe this is the idea, right? The plastic culture creates society that, you know, where the meaning of that society is plastic, not love.
What if she said Rihanna?
What if she said plastic love? I actually, years ago, was writing a short story called Plastic Kiss. It was about a dildo that was sitting in a girl's drawer and lamenting that she got a boyfriend and she doesn't play with him anymore. And it was all the thoughts of the dildo in the drawer. And it was about this plastic, you know, the plastic lover. You know, it's interesting. I think we're a culture that puts so much value on our sort of artificial recreations. We bring this right back to the AI, the golems, all this sort of stuff that we've been talking about. I think, you know, we're Is there a danger in finding value in our little Synecdoche, New York recreations? Are we getting lost in there, or do we just have to make something amazing?
You know, back to something as simple as jigsaw puzzles. Do you know when the first jigsaw puzzle was invented?
I want to talk about dildos.
Well, this gets back to dildos.
I'm kidding.
So, when do you think the first jigsaw puzzle was invented?
It was probably called the Pyramid of Giza. No, I don't know.
It's like 300 years ago or something. 400 years ago, at least in the history books. Which just seems so fucking absurd, correct?
Well, what I was saying is, like, think of the pyramid, you know, think of the pyramids. How do you build it? You know, how is that not a jigsaw puzzle?
Well, in the sense that you don't have a something.
I think I understand. Like, they're like an actual jigsaw puzzle. Because a jigsaw puzzle is they make one thing and then cut it up. It literally is the salve coagula. It's like the jigsaw puzzle was a thing, then you cut it into pieces, take it apart, and then put it back together.
I bet you it was a puzzle of some sort that was around and then went away, you know, because it conditions the mind to see and to perceive in a way that is the greatest tool. I mean, the whole Osirian story is a jigsaw puzzle.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, because its roots go so deeply, because it emerged from a center point in the mind that is transcendent, that unites all of human beings throughout the world. Maybe plastic life is something that unites us from a different angle. Maybe it's something that, plastic life is invading China, right? I mean, that's the whole goal of a controlling corporate structure, is to get you to purchase plastic life, because there's planned obsolescence. It's cheap, it breaks down, and you don't feel bad when it breaks down because you can just buy another. And then you just enter that plastic loop.
Yeah. This is pretty.
Okay. But we haven't invented anything to digest it yet. You know, like, how do you transform? Oh, my goodness. How do we transform plastic into food for something that turns it back into something? It seems like every once in a while I see winks of this happening.
Dad, I'm playing with my.
My wife really pays attention to this idea of, like, all the plastics, the BPA and stuff, like all the stuff that leaks into the soil and the water, and that all our food has all this, like, garbage in it from the plastics. Beyond even just that you can't get rid of the plastics themselves, it's getting harder and harder to not even engage it. It's kind of like the, you know, if we want to take this as a solipsistic thing, it's like the shadow. It's like, I just don't want to deal with plastic, so I won't buy bottled water anymore. It's like, well, it's seeping into your soil and your water supply, and it's going to find you. You know, like, you don't want to deal with it, but it's there.
But again, you know, it would be easy to say plastic is the bad guy.
Right.
When in fact, it's us. I mean, plastic isn't going to go away until we say, oh, plastic's killing me. And then even then, what? It's like there's so many of us, if we said we should only use natural fibers that break down naturally, you know, then do we destroy the planet trying to get natural rubber plants, or, you know, cut down all the trees? It's like this is the real puzzle here is how do you put it all back together without breaking the cube or pulling the stickers off? And maybe I'm still just trying to work like one face of the thing. That if the algorithm's there, Because, you know, the heroes of all time have already done this. You go into the underworld, you get the boon, and you come back, and you reform society.
Well, Doug, I told you we might go into the underworld today, and I think we did.
What was it, the Doom Patrol, or
what
was
that?
The Doom Patrol,
Doom,
you were calling
Doom
it?
Doom Zone? Doom?
The Doom Zone.
That reminds me. Oh, now I'm thinking of the video game Moon Patrol.
For the Atari 2600?
Well, I remember it, the arcade version.
Well, then did you like that I put the Arkanoid little bit in that image there?
Perfect.
But so... You know, that's exactly what I'm saying, though. So, like, my kids are in commercial culture. They don't have any judgment. Angry Birds is the coolest stuff in the world. You know, like, Webkinz and Wizard 101 and all this weird pop stuff. Like, we listen to pop radio in the car, and it's so plastic. It's so bad. It's, you know, it's just... And how can you compare that to jazz, like, from the 20s? It's like, oh, those guys... They had style, they had class, and we are garbage. But is that just our perspective being in the flow of things? You know, they were dealing with the limitations of their time. You know, sure, they wore beautiful clothes, but they probably had two outfits. They, you know, they had a suit that they wore every single day, and then five pairs of underwear or something, you know, or the suit that they wore to church and the suit that they wore every day.
Right.
Have you ever watched The Third Man?
Yes.
It's a wonderful movie, but the guy wears the same outfit the whole movie.
I didn't notice that.
And it's like, why wouldn't he just, you know, put different clothes on every day? Well, clothes actually cost money then. They weren't plastic.
Yeah.
And basically free.
Yeah, you know, let me tell you something. A few years ago, I bought a shirt at H&M, and I only shopped there once. It was like I bought a shirt, and I was like, oh, this is pretty cool, and it's a really cheap shirt, and, you know, like, that's pretty nice, you know? And then within, like, 3 days, it was falling apart, and I was like, oh, that's why. And, you know, it's like, exactly, we don't make anything to last. What actually sucks is, like, when we talk about things like biodegrading, like, the idea is, so the plastic lasts forever, but it doesn't last forever in the form we want it to. It's like, we have plastic clothes, but it's not like, hey, you can beat the shit out of that shirt and it's gonna, you only have to buy one pair of pants for the rest of your life. No, those pants are gonna fall apart, but the materials are gonna last forever. Like, that, this, we sort of have it backwards.
Is it like the car that can drive 89 miles on a gallon of gas? Is there a pair of pants that last 10 years that they're just withholding from
us? Somewhere in, like, a DARPA lab, there's, like, some guy sitting there going, I have the perfect... Those are the pants that the Incredible Hulk wears.
Yes!
I keep hoping that, like, you know, of course this is what we were sold, but I keep hoping that the future is something like... Bill and Ted, you know, that even our crappy music, our crappy everything could actually save the world. We were sold this idea, like, hey, if Bill and Ted go back to, like, you know, they're going to see Socrates, as they call him, and he's going to think they're the coolest thing ever. You know, like, we've got some beautiful thing that we're going to save the world even with our, you know, inane garbage. And as silly as it all seems, and as ridiculous as it seems, and almost distasteful as it seems, God, I hope that's true. I hope there's a way to, you know, if what we have is this stuff, I hope that it has a value.
Well, it's assimilating at a rate that, because of how desperate all channels of media are. The fact that, you know, there's that show on Fox, Touch, right, which is a sync show. The fact that exists without the sort of ripples that you would think it would have had within the Sync community. There was no sense of, we told you, look, it's on TV. It's more of like, oh, those bastards are, it's a bullshit project, and it's a plastic version of what the real Sync community is all about. But it didn't even inspire rage. It just sort of.
But did you ever watch it? I watched one episode. I thought it was like, I actually really wanted. I really like everyone kept writing to me and saying, "Oh, you gotta watch this. You gotta watch it. It's so Sync-y." And then I was like, "All right, fuck it." And I watched an episode, and I was like, "It was actually very boring. It wasn't even like I was angry that they stole an idea or they're abusing an idea. I just thought it was really boring and poorly acted." That was my
opinion. that's the whole point, right, Alan? Is that okay? So someone's going to build a show with the skeletal system of Sync as its foundation. Well, as it manifests to the public, if it's fucking boring and it's cheap, well, right there, 60% of the people won't watch it. And then you eliminate 50% of people who are interested in Sync because it's boring. And then because it's so obvious, you have people dismissing it because it's, fringe psychology. It offends people on a sort of intelligence level. And then at the end of the day, 3 or 4 years from now, when Sync maybe has a second wave, people will say, oh, didn't they already do a show about that? That show was bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it just cuts into whatever Sync will want to do to manifest itself when it has some balls to it, you know? And I don't know how I got to Sync with balls, but,
Thanks. I'm glad we can get back to balls.
You know, it's that whole Gurdjieff thing. You've got to bury the dog deeper. You know what I mean? You have to know it so well. You need to, if you're going to manifest it, you need to not make it explicit and superficial. You need to bury the crux of the thing so deep. And then people said, well, don't you mean bury the bone deeper? He's like, no, bury the dog deeper. And the dog he was referring to is, of course, Sirius, you know? And then there you go. You're in the rabbit hole and you're off and running. But it's just, there's just a frenzy. And there's a frenzy that is given so much, it's just all out in front of us. You know what I mean? It's, I don't know. I lost my thought, but.
No, I hear you. I mean, ultimately, I agree. It's the idea of like not. I struggle with this. I think we were talking about this, like the idea of like not being so explicit and just, you know, this is ultimately, this is probably what we're finding. I mean, when a lot of people are, and I do like to make the distinction, this isn't necessarily Sync work, but like when people are analyzing movies and you go, oh, hey, I didn't even notice there's that movie poster in the background and, you know, on the wall in The Shining, and some people are going to go like, oh, you read too much into things, and maybe you're just digging up the dog that someone buried really well, you know?
Exactly.
So these are two ways to go about it. But I also know that there is an element of Sync where it didn't have to be planned. Even if, you know, even if Stanley Kubrick might have buried a dog really deep so that you'll, you know, if you really know where to look for it, you'll find it. But the guy who made... it was like, it's amazing. Like, Jason was showing me like Disney's The Rocketeer, and it was like had like the exact same elements as, I think it was Eyes Wide Shut. You know, it was like saying like, there was like no distinction between the two movies. A lot of the shots were the same, a lot of everything, and Rocketeer actually came out first. And it was like, so here you have, you know, the lowbrow that might have been unintentional, sort of just, hey, I just want to make something fun and silly, and it all just pops in there. And then you have the master craftsman who actually knows what he's doing. And what we're again, I would probably enjoy the Kubrick movie more because there's that other element to it. But as far as the dog is in both of them, you know what I mean?
Yes, for sure.
I agree. There's a buried dog in both, and one was maybe intentionally buried, and one was they were just building on top of a pet cemetery and didn't even realize it.
I don't know. It seems like this conversation is always going to kind of arrive at this point where we're in it. We want to understand it so that we can influence it. But perspective is not impossible, but very difficult. Especially in a quantum universe where there is
yeah if so the fractals in you, how do you look out upon it? Oh, you
right.
Look,
so
you
it's
look
like
inside.
can you take that fractal and say, well, this is everything, or is that doing a disservice to the macrocosm?
Well, it's a Zen riddle for us all to sort of ponder until next week.
But just for the record, I'm you guys use the word tripping or meditating. I use compelled to follow, you know, so it's like the medieval Grail Quest where you follow the stag into the forest. I'm compelled to follow Rihanna because it seems like she embodies our age, and I want to understand our age, and I don't understand, you know, she's really, really exploded recently, and she's beautiful, but she's not, there's, you know, she's plastic. Beyonce feels so much more authentic to me, but for some reason, I'm just compelled by Rihanna. And so this, and I'm not saying that like, you know, a Joycean universe exists within, but there's definitely something there that I have to follow at this point. It may, you know, lead me.
Doug, what you said there that kind of brings my attention a lot clearer is that the pop song she sings is one thing, but what she embodies and why she is in that world stage is another thing. And I completely understand that perspective wholeheartedly, that out of all the candidates, why was she chosen? And now that she's chosen, why is it that she can be, you know, just something like she can be brutally beaten by her boyfriend and both of their careers can continue to be successful? There's something very disturbing about that, and it does command a lot of attention. So I think that for me to focus on just a pop song that she sings and say, well, that's plastic, well, that's obvious, right? I mean, the song itself is an obvious plastic component. But I think you're very correct to deconstruct the drama that she's living in, the fiction that she's swimming in.
Her neon mouth with a blingatall smile, nothing but an electric sign. You could say she has an individual style, she's a part of a carnival time. Super steel lady, chrome covered clothes you wear, cause you have no other. But I suppose no one knows you're my plastic, fantastic lover. Shuts all, there's nothing but a used machine. Her aluminum finish, slightly diminished, is the best I ever have seen. Cosmetic baby, plugged into me, and never ever find another. And I really. realize no one's wise to my plastic, fantastic lover. Electrical dust is starting to rust, her trapezoid thermometer taste. All the red tape is mechanical rape of the TV program waste. Data control and IBM science is mankind's brother, but all I see is draining me on my plastic, fantastic lover.
So I hope I didn't.
Oh no!